Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and my guest today on the program is Patrick Lee. His new novel, Runner, just came out. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
I did something a little different for this one, Patrick. Normally, I am a Luddite, and I'll just read the regular book. I don't read the electronic book. I read the one with pages. But for this one, I thought, I'm going to listen to the audiobook version, and
I did.
And I'll tell you, I loved it.
Oh, that's great. It's great to hear. Yeah, they got Raul Esparza to do it, which I was really impressed that he did it.
He does a little girl really well.
Oh, yeah, it's interesting to hear people do voices, especially reading it. For an author, when you hear someone doing it, you're hoping that you don't get this person's voice in your head forever when you're writing your next book. No matter who it is, even if someone does it really well like that. But I'm fascinated by how people do that.
Well,
they do the voice work.
It must be even worse than Patrick if they end up making your book into a movie, right? Then you have that face in your head, right?
I suppose so. Yeah, that would be interesting. I guess that would qualify as a really good problem to have to deal with somewhere down the road.
Well, I don't want to jinx it, but I understand that there's been some interest in this book for a Hollywood film, and we won't even talk about that. But
a little bit. It's kind of early days on it, but I'm really, really excited. Fingers crossed.
So before we get into the story, tell us a little bit about yourself. I understand that you've written a couple previous books, but this is the first one that I've read of yours, and wow, this is a thriller.
Thank you. Thanks. Yeah. So this will be my fourth book to come out, and the first three were a trilogy that were unrelated to this, and those were a little bit more sci-fi, but although still present day and fairly ordinary characters, but that ended as a trilogy, and then so this will be the start of a new series now.
Well, this has certainly got some sci-fi elements in it.
Yeah. It's fun to have. I like to have one strange thing in a story, and then try to make everything else as realistic as I can. It seems to be pretty fun. It helps, I guess, for me just as a writer. It helps create kind of a gauge to measure how it's how it's going. How real am I keeping it?
So set the scene in Runner. Tell our listeners what's transpiring.
Sure. So Runner is about a guy named Sam Dryden. And at the beginning of the book, he's going through a bad part of his life. He's in his mid-30s, and he used to be in the military, but he's been out for a while. And he lost his wife and young daughter to an accident, so he's just kind of stuck in this emotional limbo. And one night when he's running on the boardwalk, he encounters this young girl named Rachel, who's running away from people that are trying to kill her. And he helps her escape from them, and she soon reveals that she has an ability that should be impossible. So the story unfolds as he tries to help her, stay safe from these people that are after her, and also try to figure out how she got this ability, because she actually can't remember her past beyond a couple months. So she doesn't really know how she can do the things that she can do, and it's about putting the puzzle pieces together and finding out where she came from and who she really is.
And Sam Dryden is one of these guys where if you were to look into his background, you'd find that there's just a big black hole, kind of an empty gap where you can't get any information about him.
Exactly. I thought that would be an interesting thing to give him this thing in his past that we don't necessarily find out very much about. And I guess it'll remain to be seen if we delve into it more in future books, but there would never be much of a actual flashback that tells us about it, but we might just hear more about it.
We also have a bad guy in this story who I don't know how much you want to talk about. The thing with the story is you don't know who the bad guys and the good guys really are. It's kind of confusing.
I kind of like having that a little bit of ambiguity where you can at least see where the bad guys are coming from. And sometimes you can maybe overdo it a little. I hope I haven't, but it's probably possible to make them empathetic enough that you can, if you see their point, you could it makes it a little bit less clear, but I'm pretty hopeful that they're bad enough. The choices they make are certainly pretty bad.
My guest is Patrick Lee. His new novel is Runner, just published. And does the runner allude to the fact that he's jogging as he begins, and then they spend the rest of the story running?
I suppose on the surface it's that, and I'm sure there's a couple different layers of possible meaning. But yeah, I know that it was. It's actually funny that sort of coming up with a title for this was actually fairly tough. Right up until it was done, there was no particular title that myself or my editor or my agent all really liked, and the name Runner emerged out of a lot of sort of back and forth emailing and phone calling, and we all liked that it was very kinetic, and it did capture, you know, how the story starts, obviously, but also the fact that they're on the run for most of the book, and it was the one name we all really liked, and it just for some reason it kind of clicked.
Well, I really loved listening to the audiobook because it really ratcheted up the tension for me. And when you have scenes like the one where they're under the boardwalk, or the one where they're driving along and there's someone following them, I mean, this just so well done. How do you do that? How do you build up that tension like that?
Oh, thanks. Yeah, some of that stuff is pretty hard. It's hard to know exactly how it's working. I feel like I redo things quite a lot, and after a while, you sort of recognize when it seems to work. There's something to, you know, you want to end the chapters on a hook. You want to make it hard for people to put the book down, even if it's, you know, 2 a.m. and they have to work the next day. So that's the evil plan to make people miss out on sleep.
Well, thank you. At 2 o'clock in the morning, you know what I was doing last night.
thanks for listening to it.
Patrick, just hearing your voice on the telephone, you sound very youthful.
Oh, thanks.
How old are you?
I'm 37.
Okay. You've got a very young voice. How did you get into this? How did you become a writer, and what were you doing before that?
Yeah, so before writing books, I was actually trying to write screenplays for a long time. And in my 20s, I sold a couple of them, and they made it to various stages of development. I really don't know how close they got to getting made, but at times we had actors attached. I think I had Ice Cube attached to something of mine at one point. And it's at the time, you know, when it sounds like something's going to get made, it really sounds like it. And then, you know, you never quite find out why deals fall apart. But I think it's, you know, probably more the rule than the exception that movie deals end up going by the wayside. But I started doing that. I actually started trying to write screenplays right after high school. It was just, at the time, it seemed like, you know, something that might take forever. I thought, you know, I would just still have some regular, you know, more of a normal career, and maybe sometime 10 or 15 years down the road, maybe something would finally sell. But I was about 22 when the first one sold, and 24 when the next one sold. But yeah, beyond that, nothing actually got, you know, nothing actually was greenlighted or produced. So
you know how it works, or doesn't work.
Yeah. I've learned a lot of ways to not get a movie made.
But when you say they bought it, they gave you money even though they didn't make it.
Right. Yeah. That's the funny thing is that they still pay you for the scripts. And in fact, there was an interesting thing that happened. So on my first one, they pay you a certain amount, and it's kind of complicated, but there's a certain purchase price, but then they'll designate the first half of that as what you get for the script, and the second half is what you get for all the rewrites. So they pay you that part, the first part up front, and then the second part you'll eventually get after you're done doing the rewrites. But it's a strange thing, I guess. It must be something to do with contracts. But if a director comes on board who brings in their own writer, and they decide to fire you as the writer, they still have to pay you whatever they were going to pay you to do those rewrites.
Uh-huh.
So, which happened on my first one. They brought in a director who had a writer that he just always worked with. And so I got kind of an interesting phone call. It's like, on the one hand, sorry, but you're fired. And on the other hand, here's a huge check for the other half of the script price. So
that's crazy, but it must happen a lot.
Yeah, I think so. It must be how things normally work. And I guess on the scale of what things cost in Hollywood, you know, like explosions, you know, movies where aliens are blowing up the whole planet, I guess maybe the prices for screenplays are, considered manageable compared to that.
Yeah. Patrick Lee is our guest. His new novel is Runner. I was reading, I think you did an interview late last year with Publishers Weekly where you mentioned some of the writers that you like, and one of them was Bill Bryson. We've had him on the program a number of times. In fact, we had him on for his most recent book.
I read that one, 1927. That's a great book.
I asked him, I said, so Bill, I understand that A Walk in the Woods was optioned by Robert Redford. What's the story? What's going on? And that apparently it was 10 years ago.
Oh, wow.
And Redford bought it, and he was going to cast himself and Nick Nolte, but so far I guess it's never been made, but I'm sure they paid him.
Yeah, they must have. That would be actually a really good movie.
I think it would too.
Funny. Yeah, that was, I've been a huge fan of his. 1927 was amazing. There was so much about it that I didn't realize, I love the thing about this, baseball fields at that time weren't nearly as uniform as they are now, that there might just be clumps of weeds in the outfield somewhere that you had to look out for.
Right. Or
had to imagine it.
Or the ground would rise up. You had to run up a... right. Uh-huh.
Yeah, there might be a hill out there. It's funny how things like that don't really make it into the main, the sort of the history that we hear, and someone like him can really illustrate it a lot better.
Well, if you're a fan of A Walk in the Woods, you probably would be amazed to know that we actually had Stephen Katz on this program.
Oh, wow. That's great.
And it's the only interview he's ever done.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Because there was, I thought I read somewhere, I'm sure it was, I think it was a pseudonym, but was there some disagreement between them about the exact way it was described, or was it sort of a joke? He sort of said it jokingly that not quite everything was...
Well, Stephen took issue with some of his portrayal in the book, but they're still good friends.
And that is
a pseudonym. You're right.
Yeah.
But we digress.
the fun digression.
Patrick Lee joins us. His new novel is Runner. We have some really bizarre sci-fi elements here. How much of this is your imagination, and how much is inspired by things that you think might actually be happening?
It's hard to say. I try to throw in as much of the real science that I know as possible, and then I definitely, pull a lot of it out of thin air too. But so the stuff about how DNA works, and the fact that DNA is kind of a more like a recipe than a blueprint, that there are older genes that have been crossed out, sort of like lines crossed out of a recipe. And that it is actually possible to uncross them out, that you probably have things in your genome that could tell you how to regrow an arm if we ever find out how to do that. And the reason scientists think that is that animals that can do it, like salamanders, we have the same ancestors as them if you go back far enough. And so I thought that it would be interesting that if some of Rachel's abilities are, if it's basically the result of some experiment to simply switch on genes that our ancestors had in their normal lives, maybe 100 million years ago, long before there were humans or maybe even mammals. And although I think in the book it's supposed to be something from like 20 million years ago, so they were mammal ancestors. But it's fun to be able to dress it up and to get to use as much of the real science as possible as you can, but still, it's obviously still really quite a bit of fantasy too.
That is a wonderful, wild imagination coming up with that kind of stuff. And then we've got the imagination of, gee, how can we use some of these abilities to commit crimes?
Right. that's the part, that's where probably, following science and then following, let's say, politics, you get this interesting mix of your sort of views of the world, and you try to imagine how would politicians use this, or how would their staffers who give them plausible deniability for things, how would the really kind of slimy characters use this stuff in real life? And it's pretty fun.
What was your process in writing the character for Rachel? How did you connect with this young girl in your mind and try to make it seem real?
It's hard to, I'm trying to remember. I know that I wanted her character to be really vulnerable in the beginning, to seem like about as vulnerable as someone could be, and then knowing at the time that this was you know, I had some sense of where the story might be going. I never really outlined, but I had a sense of, you know, she should probably turn out to be somebody who's not only not vulnerable, but actually a potentially, you know, dangerous character, someone she herself would be afraid of. You know, if I'm close to giving away stuff in the story, but just the idea that her abilities, where they came from, could make her a formidable character.
It's very complex.
Thanks.
It's kind of like DNA. It's these strands wrapped around each other, and you're trying to decipher what all this means. It's confusing, which was fun. And then we have all this action. There's helicopters, there's car chases, all this action, crazy action. And you said you don't outline. Does that mean that you kind of let the story take you away and see where it goes?
Yeah, for the most part, I do. I follow Stephen King's advice from his book On Writing, where he said that if he's surprising himself with where the story goes, then hopefully he can surprise the readers too. Although it's not that it's happening like page by page. Like I definitely always have a sense of where I think it's going, and usually I would say by the time I'm halfway through a book, I'm pretty sure how it's going to end. Although, you know, sort of certain twists could come along at times. It also means doing a lot of backtracking, so I'll have a certain idea if I'm, let's say, three quarters of the way through the book, and I'll suddenly realize it's like you've written all this stuff, so you've got all these components of it, and then you realize what you could do with those components of the story, stuff that you might not have thought of when you were starting out, and then I'll have an idea for a twist, and I'll realize that I'd have to go back and change like 20 things. It would completely redo the story, but if it's worth it, you know, if it feels like it makes it better, then I'll go back and make all the changes. And the end result, it ends up looking like it was outlined, but it's kind of, you could sort of call it retroactive outlining. It ends up being really organized, but not necessarily planned in advance.
When you go back and backtrack and have to change stuff like that, it's almost like a form of archaeology. And the interview we did just before this one, this is the second interview in a row where the Stephen King book On Writing has been referred to. I didn't realize that book was so influential.
Yeah, for me it really was. I actually read it a couple times when I was still writing screenplays and trying to decide, and I knew I wanted to try books. And I think it may have had at least some influence on, you know, it may have been the reason had something to do with when I switched, because it really kind of, it confirmed some of what I thought would be fun about writing books. It sounded like you could just really sort of just run with the story and let it take shape as you go.
My guest is Patrick Lee. His new novel is Runner, just published. And I get contacted by aspiring writers rather frequently asking me if I can help them get their book published. And I'll usually just tell them, well, I think you probably need to find an agent because that's not my thing. So how does it work for you? How did you get published?
Actually, it was pretty straightforward. The first book I wrote was in the year 2007, and I bought a book. I actually just walked into the local bookstore and bought a copy of the 2007 Guide to Literary Agents, and I sort of read through the section that lists the agencies and circled the ones that were looking for material that sounded like what I was writing, and came up with a list of about 30 of them, and I actually sent it out with a cover letter, and it was, I must have read somewhere online that you should send them at least send a first chapter. Some of them actually really specify what you should send, like they want 5 pages or 15 pages or something, but pretty much at least send a something, you know, send 5 pages or something so that they can see the writing. And it was sent it out, and I noticed that all the good news came back by email, and all the cover or all the, you know, the form letter rejections came by regular mail. I ended up signing with an agent that I'm actually still with, and it was that was actually probably, in a way, that was actually the most exciting step, just suddenly having an agent, because you go from, you know, being really, you know, feeling like you're nowhere because you haven't really taken a step into it yet, to suddenly, you know, you've made this huge step, and that part was, really exciting.
That's the wonderful thing about email is you can sit down, you've just read the first chapter, and you can immediately contact the writer and say, hey, I want to represent you before someone else emails you.
Great. Exactly. Yeah, it's one of the great things with being in the modern age. I can't imagine what it must have been like. Long ago. I mean, even when there were telephones, I'm sure people didn't. They probably didn't use those when they were. I'm sure agents wouldn't have called. They would probably. I'm sure it was all done by regular mail. That would be a nightmare waiting around for it.
And there are so many well-known writers who could paper the walls of their houses with rejection letters, and they just never gave up.
Yeah, I can imagine that would be. It must be. If the process goes on for years, I could see how it would get really dispiriting. And I'm very impressed by people that stick with it.
I have learned that it's a rather touchy thing to ask writers if they're working on a sequel or what they're doing, because they want to feel like they want to just do this process without any any nosing around by interviewers. But I'm guessing you're working on a sequel.
Yeah, there was definitely always going to be one. So the next one will be, actually, I don't know enough about it to really go into too much detail. I mean, it's well underway, but I've tried a few different approaches at it before settling on ending up with the version of book two that I really like. I can say it, it takes place a couple years later, and it still centers on Sam Dryden. It's interesting to see how it goes. I noticed that with, like in the first book, the character goes through quite a big change, and I wondered later how that, starting on book two, I noticed, it's an interesting thing. If your character has gone through a change in the first book, you definitely don't want to just reset them back to their first, how they started out the first book, and like, okay, he's all sad again. Now I've got to, have him have something else happen. So you sort of need to pick up where you left off, but yet you still want them to change again in the second book, or you want them to. Not necessarily change, but you want them to go through something, and so that's kind of that's something I'm figuring out. I feel like I've got a handle on it now.
And these are very much set in real time. The chronology from what I guessed, just the date of a birth in this book indicated to me that this was really in real time. So by the time you finish this next book, you'll still be in real time. And
right.
Are you like burrowed away in some cabin somewhere? How do you write?
Yeah, that would probably be the best way to write, actually. I sort of just write, write on my home computer. Was never able to do the thing of, writing in public, like at libraries or coffee shops. I'm not sure if it's the distraction or just, I'm not sure how that works, but I know that it's always worked better if I'm just in a really quiet place.
Yeah, I don't get that either. And there's certain writers, Laura Lippman likes to write in a coffee shop, but that's so distracting. I couldn't do it. Not that I'm a writer, but.
I would have a really hard time with it. I guess I'm sure it's just a matter of preference. I have a cousin who works in advertising, and he says working on a laptop in a public place, it works great for him. He's just able to, something about it, maybe you're just getting ideas or being surrounded by people, maybe the creativity is more active that way. But I'm sure it varies quite a bit from one person to another.
In that Publisher's Weekly piece, I did observe that some of the writers that you like to read are not novelists. You're reading nonfiction. Are there any novelists that you're getting into or that you've liked in the past?
I'm probably, as far as the writing I do, or the reading I do, it's probably about 50-50 between fiction and nonfiction. And I've always been a huge fan of Stephen King and Dean Koontz. Lee Child is probably one of my favorites lately, too. It's Lee Child's style, his style of writing is probably my favorite. That it's just very efficient and lean and right to the point. It's almost impossible to be bored reading one of his books. Totally impossible.
That's true. We've had him on the program several times, and he's very much Jack Reacher. He's very efficient. He's plotting exactly how he's going to get to where he's going, and he's going to do it very quickly.
Yeah, I've seen him a few times, like at conferences, and he kind of, I mean, you sort of get the impression this is what Jack Reacher would look like too. He's a really big guy.
Uh-huh. And I see he gave you a nice blurb.
Oh yeah, he was like super nice with that blurb. I was, it's funny. I mean, I'm at the point where I guess it's early enough in my career, or I don't know if that would change with time anyway. But I'm pretty starstruck just knowing certain writers have read the book, much less that they're blurbing it. And it's super exciting to get that.
Does your agent do that? How do they get blurbs?
I think it's from what I've seen, I think the publisher does a lot of it, and I know that my agent. So on my first book a few years ago, there was actually a blurb from Lee Child on that one, and that I think my agent managed to pull that one off. And off the top of my head, I'm actually not sure if she did this one or if the publisher did. But it's usually either the editing, usually either the publishing company or the agency.
Well, this is definitely a page turner. It's Runner by Patrick Lee. And if you really want to go wild, check out the audiobook, because Raul Esparza does a really nifty job reading that. And for those of you who are into audiobooks, you know that if the reader is good, it makes all the difference in the world, because sometimes the reader's a dud.
Yeah, that would be really depressing if that were to happen. If you're imagine popping in the CD and you're just going, "Oh my God, what?"
Yeah, I mean, they either get you, they get you, or they lose you, and right. It has nothing to do with the writer so much. It's when the reader has such a power, it's crazy.
Yeah, that's a huge skill all its own. I can only imagine it. You know, it's funny. Before I was writing novels, one of the things I occasionally thought about was, what if I had to read the audiobook, because some authors do, and I would be actually, I don't think they would necessarily want me to, but I wouldn't be, I think that just seems like that would be very difficult to actually read the thing and try to give it voice and do what these guys can really do.
Well, it's hard work, and Bill Bryson read the 1927 book on audiobook. He said it took him over a week to do it, and I would think you'd just lose your voice.
Yeah, I'm sure, yeah. I wonder how the process goes as far as restarting. You know, if you mess up a word somewhere, if you can pick it up from the last paragraph, maybe, or there must be a whole set of processes to it.
I'm sure they do a lot of cutting and pasting. I'm just kidding. Well, it's really been a pleasure having you on the program.
Oh, it's been great to be on. Thank you.
Our guest has been Patrick Lee. His new novel is Runner. For the Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis. If you ever miss an interview in the Book Nook, you can listen to them by going to our website at wyso.org. You can download podcasts of them. And while you're there, why don't you support your public radio station with a pledge? Just go to wyso.org and show your appreciation for programs like this one. The Book Nook is recorded at Soundspace in Yellow Springs and engineered by Chris Hertzler.